Hello, and welcome to TNT, the Technology and Things podcast. Your host, Paul Ferraro, is a former IT exec and currently a technology advisor. Jeff Krueger, a fellow technology enthusiast, is the co-host. They both spent many years working for a Fortune 500 company and are both passionate about leadership, technology, and the community.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today on our Technology and Things podcast. You'll notice that I'm joined by a good colleague of mine, Matt Stamper, which I've had the pleasure of knowing for, I think, 20 plus years. we go way, way back, so that's pretty cool. And also, Matt actually did a podcast with us back around, the end of last year. And we kind of talked through his career and everything. So I think you know Matt well, but just to do a quick intro to Matt. Matt is currently a CISO and a executive advisor with Evotech, and he's had quite a storied career, from working at Gartner to being a CISO at a number of companies. I think MSSP. Is that correct, Matt?
And, exactly.
And he's had a lot of time in the saddle with security and privacy and everything, and so. So for today, welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Love these.
So for today, we're going to be talking to Hilary Wandell, who is a Senior Vice President of Privacy Intelligence and a General Counsel for TrustArc. But she actually has had quite a career as well. She spent 20 years or a little more than 20 years with Merck as a Chief Privacy Officer. During her last 12 years there. So she's got a ton of experience in this space. And so we thought we just set the stage a little bit on why is this sort of relevant today? Like what's the big deal about privacy? Why do we care? Matt, maybe help us out a little bit here. What's going on with this today and why do we want to learn about it?
Yeah, I think it's odd to say this, but there's probably few areas that we see in the enterprise that are moving as fast as privacy. Privacy is really driving organizational behavior. It's changing business models. It has huge implications in terms of international information flows that I'm sure Hilary and I will touch upon. Privacy is just something that has effectively snowballed over the last several years to become something of a board level issue, certainly an executive management and executive leadership team issue for most organizations. So privacy, I think, is become one of those whole of enterprise affairs, very similar to the way we saw it with Sarbanes-Oxley and in developing good internal controls, notably around financial reporting. What we've seen with cybersecurity, where all of a sudden cybersecurity becomes a really critical issue for most areas within the organization. Privacy is not dissimilar. It fundamentally permeates how we look at the nature and extent of the information that an organization collects, how it's used, where it's shared, how it should be governed, how it should be secured, how it should be retained. All of those things, I think, have really interesting implications, notably with them when we think about information as kind of being the next oil, if you will, from a currency perspective. You know, information flows are probably more important than oil flows to the global economy. And a subset of that is obviously personal data or personally identifiable information.
When we talk about privacy, that was actually going to be my question. We talk about privacy. Are we talking mainly about people's privacy? Or are we talking about the corporation's private? Like, is there an element of that that the company also has a stake in?
There's in the corporate context, the way we would look at it would be material non-public information, MNPI. And this is effectively information that could be used for insider trading or to have an advantage over the rest of the market if we were looking at public companies. As it relates to privacy, fundamentally, we're looking at things like personal data as defined in Article 4 of the GDPR, personally identifiable information or personal information as defined in a number of state statutes, certainly within the California Consumer Privacy Act. But it's effectively our information and how organizations use it, whether they're using it in a way that's consistent with what they told us as consumers, as individuals, or if they're doing things with that information in a way that we weren't aware, and perhaps even different from what they've stated they would do.
Got it.
And I think one of the things that Hillary and I will end up talking about is the role of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, in its enforcement of Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act that speaks to unfair and deceptive trade practices.
No, it sounds good, Matt. I think that, looking forward to getting this going. We've got Hillary on the line, so I'm gonna let her in here in a second. And I think that, just so you guys know that are listening, I'm going to try to, these guys obviously know a ton about this space. And so if we get into areas that, like, I'm sitting there with a blank stare, I'm going to try to ask some questions and try to make sure that we're keeping this interesting. And also, that I really want people to learn something about out of this today and so I think I'll try to play that role. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and let Hillary in here. Hello, Hillary.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Great to see you.
Great to see you, too. Happy Friday.
No doubt. As it were.
Well, thank you for very much, Hillary, for coming on our Technology and Things podcast today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's really... Yeah, it's going to be fun. So Matt and I were just kind of talking a little bit. We did a little quick intro and just were talking a little bit about kind of the topic for today around privacy. And so I thought we kind of maybe kick it off, Hillary, with maybe just give us a quick, overview of your kind of background. We did a little introduction, but I'd love to hear it from you.
Well,
how you got here.
Happy to do that. I have to say, today, and in particular for the last week with this Schrems 2 decision hanging mm-hmm. over all of our heads, I have to say I feel like I've been in privacy forever. Really, it's been about two decades at this point. But the reason I feel like it's forever is I feel like there's so many problems we've been trying to solve for. Since the very beginning when I was around and people were trying to solve it before I was involved. So back in the 1990s and even in the 1980s with the first original OECD privacy guidelines. And here we are in July of 2020 trying to figure out how on earth to move data around the world. And we're confronted with a problem that has more challenges associated with it than we've ever had in the past. Anyway, so that's a little bit about how I feel about my career in privacy at the moment. A little perplexed as to how we're going to move forward. But nevertheless, we find solutions, and we have in the past. So I started out as a privacy person inside of Merck, really first in the marketing side of things. I happened to stumble across privacy as something we needed to worry about on websites with this law called COPPA back in 1999 when it first became effective. It was adopted in 1998, and that's really how I stumbled into privacy and then helped Merck set up its first global privacy program. And I've been doing privacy ever since. I started leading the global program there in 2004 and did so until 2016 when I came to TrustArc. And there were a lot of things in between while I was leading the privacy program there, but I came to TrustArc really because I saw in the 2016 timeframe, right after GDPR had been finalized, the final text had been adopted, an opportunity to move privacy for lots of different businesses out of the compliance with a particular law and just kind of doing jurisdictional by jurisdictional requirements or, looking at it strictly through a legal lens or just a compliance lens to more of a strategic business obligation that could be supported effectively through a combination of robust technology, real well integrated research and knowledge as part of that. And then what I'm now having a little bit of doubt about, but certification solutions, and frameworks, starting with the OECD privacy guidelines and things like the APEC privacy framework, how do those things help facilitate organizations being responsible data stewards? So anyway, a bit of a window into my thinking about privacy. I would summarize it all up in that I feel that it is an obligation that organizations have, not just to comply with the law, but really to be responsible data stewards as they use data to drive their businesses. And everything that we in the privacy space should really be focused on is driving and helping businesses aim toward that goal. And there's a lot of complexity, unfortunately, that just got added to it in the last week. So,
and the one you're referring to with the last week, is that the Privacy Shield?
Yeah, you want to jump in on that a little bit? I'll give you my 2 cents.
Yeah, sure. I obviously know nothing about this space, but or very little. So I was looking at, Matt and I were talking about it earlier in the week, and I looked it up on the website, and I was trying to understand kind of a little bit about it. But I'd love to learn more about, you know, what that was for, you know, originally, and maybe then we could talk about kind of what's changed as well.
Yeah, and I will start by saying there have been people in deep in the privacy corner that's been immersed in this, like reading the decision, the judgment of the court is 63 pages long, and there was an opinion of the Advocate General that was about, I can't remember exactly, but like 80 pages long. So there's a lot of legal text around this, and everybody's been reading it and rereading it and talking and trying to figure out. You know, the European Data Protection Board came out with some FAQs today. Anyway, it's complicated, but let me try to summarize it for the listeners in a simple way. So laws like GDPR, and there's actually over 100 laws around the world that have restrictions on moving data out of the country. So it's basically in the requirements in the law, one of them is you can't send data to another country. They call it transfer data. International data transfers, you can't do that unless the country you're sending it to meets some basic requirements. And one of the core requirements is something they call adequacy in the law, in the court's opinions, they call it essential equivalence to the standards in the country in which the data originated. So this has been something that many of the, starting in Europe, but many of the regulators have been focused on, and many of the laws have been focused on for a number of decades now. The predecessor to GDPR, a law called the Data Protection Directive, EU Data Protection Directive, had very similar requirements. And in fact, this case that was just decided was based on that old law, even though it's now related to GDPR. So Privacy Shield and its predecessor, Safe Harbor, were a way that the U.S., negotiated with the European Commission, which is basically the decider of adequacy for the EU, as to how US organizations were going to protect the data so that they provided that adequacy or that essential equivalence. And it goes all the way back to 2000. So we have the predecessor to Privacy Shield. That was something called Safe Harbor. And it was negotiated between the U.S. Department of Commerce on behalf of the U.S. government and the European Commission on behalf of the European or the EU community back in 2000. And organizations like mine, I was actually one of the first early adopters of it, signed up to say that our company will protect the data we receive from the EU in accordance with these standards. And what that does is it then allows you by saying every year you self-certify, you go through a big audit internally or you have an outside reviewer tell you you're meeting the requirements, and then you self-certify every year we're meeting the requirements. And that basically gives comfort to everybody in Europe that they can send data to you and everything's going to be okay. The legal requirements have been met. The data will be protected. People will have rights, etc. So that was all fine and good. Lots of organizations signed up over the course of 2000 to 2011. And then we had the Snowden revelations. And people got very concerned about the fact that Europeans' data was not being adequately protected in the US, particularly by companies that were subject to a national security requests, from the intelligence agencies, and that was actually not allowing organizations to truly protect the data appropriately because they would have to turn over the data to the federal government. yeah. and not necessarily give people rights to know what was happening, to get the proper judicial remedies in the court. So this is in 2011, people started being worried after the Snowden revelations. And in 2015, October 6th specifically, the Court of Justice of the European Union, the highest court in the European Union, basically like our Supreme Court, said the safe harbor is invalidated. It does not provide adequate protection. So all you 5,000 companies that signed up to say you were protecting data, even if you never were subject to a request from the intelligence agencies, you are no longer able to receive data in the US pursuant to the safe harbor. And all the organizations in the EU that were sending data to you could no longer rely on that. So everybody was shocked. This is October 6, 2015. Everybody's shocked. What do we do? So a lot of organizations said, we're going to do the easiest thing we can do. We're going to enter into contracts. There's these special form of contracts, same body European Commission adopted, said that these would work anywhere in the world as long as you, the data exporter from the EU, and the company that you're sending data to, wherever they are in the world, not just the US, anywhere, China, Russia, not Argentina because they're out, but like South Africa, just, you know, basically any country in the world, you can enter into these contracts. And as long as you enter into the contract and they agree to follow the obligations pursuant to the contract, then you're okay. So a lot of organizations said, we don't have safe harbor anymore. We're going to enter into all these contracts. Know this. That became the subject of the new court case that just got decided last week. So the same guy who raised the concerns about safe harbor raised concerns about these clauses, these contracts that were approved by the European Commission. And in doing so, it went through a series, you know, the things in the courts take a long time.
Yeah.
So what are the things? And in the meantime, by July of 2016, the US government and the European Commission, voila, had negotiated a replacement to Safe Harbor called Privacy Shield. And so as this case, known as Schrems II, is winding itself through the courts and all the hearings in Ireland, then it gets referred to the Court of Justice, there's this Privacy Shield. And in the meantime, 5,000 plus, actually 5,300 organizations signed up and said, we're going to protect the data according to these standards, and the European Commission has said that all the national security things have been properly cared for, so we're good, right? We're going to do this. And look, everybody wants to be able to rely on a more systematic approach like this, where they can have somebody say, yes, I'm meeting these standards, whether that's an internal audit team or an outside reviewer. They commit to it to the government, and they don't have to worry about every single time you enter into any transaction or do any data flow, you've got to enter into a new contract. That's transactionally messy, and it's not necessarily good for organizations focusing on handling data effectively, using it strategically, appropriate risk management. So fast forward to last week, the court invalidated Privacy Shield. Now, they did so on a case that was all about invalidating these standard contractual clauses. They did not invalidate the standard contractual clauses. However, how we end up with the mess that we are now in is they said, every single transfer needs to go through a case-by-case analysis. So just because you've entered into these clauses doesn't mean that it's okay anymore. You need to review whether for each flow, for each importer, whether they're truly able to comply, whether they're subject to these national security, like that particular receiver of data, are they subject to these national security requirements? And if so, guess what? You likely can't rely on that, so you need to look for something else. And the problem is, we don't know what else there is.
Right,
yeah. Binding corporate rules and...
Yeah, so I don't want a whole hour on this topic because it is like the big thing right now. But the problem, bottom line, is that data transfers, are at least out of the European Union, are now a mess. The Swiss Privacy Shield is still in place for the moment. We don't know exactly what's going to happen there, but privacy risk management just got exponentially more important.
Yeah, and in fact, to your point, Hillary, some of the DPAs within Germany are actually questioning the validity of standard contractual clauses. And so when we start thinking about international data flows coming out of the European Union, the DPAs in Germany are saying, if you've got infrastructure that's in the US, bring it to Europe. So effectively, this is a bit of a protectionist perspective from a U.S. Point of view. But when we look at it from a European perspective, these are inherent human rights, the right to have privacy over the information that we have versus national security interests in the United States. And so we are really, from my view, at a fundamental impasse. And Paul, just for your a little bit of background, when Privacy Shield was invalidated, there was no transition period. It was as of that moment when the Court of Justice for the European Union said no, it stopped. And so organizations are literally trying to figure out how to handle this right now. And it's an inordinately challenging issue. So,
yeah, I was thinking that probably there's a lot of war rooms going on where they're trying to figure out, what do we do now? How do we, make sure that we're following some kind of law or standard, or what are we doing, right?
So you have two options right now. You've got binding corporate rules, which take a long time to be approved, and standard contractual clauses. The challenge with standard contractual clauses is that it appears that they are likely to be invalidated at some point in the future, and or that you're going to have really disparate rulings from various data protection authorities throughout Europe. So you've got the UK and France, which are a little bit more open to standard contractual clauses. You've got the Netherlands and Germany that are effectively saying, we're not even sure if these are valid. And so you're going to, very similar, one of the criticisms of US privacy law is that it's a patchwork. It always gets described as there's 50 states, 50 different approaches. Save for things like HIPAA, we don't really have good national privacy protections other than some of the work that the Federal Trade Commission does. But fundamentally, Europe is starting to look a little bit like that as well, where you might have very different practices relative to SCCs, the standard contractual clauses, from one jurisdiction in Europe versus the whole of Europe authorizing inappropriate onward transfer or international transfer approach. So our world just got inordinately complicated.
So let's take a, because like Hillary said, we could spend probably a whole hour on that. But I want to take a couple twists and turns. So maybe since I've got both a CISO and a privacy officer kind of on here together, I thought it would be interesting to kind of get your perspectives on how do you guys collaborate together in a typical company? What does that collaboration look like? Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll start with Hillary and maybe then get Matt's perspective.
Yeah, it's, I think, so critical and so exciting to be doing this together with Matt, because obviously you can't do privacy effectively without security. You could argue you can do security well without privacy, but I think that's becoming more and more problematic, at least because of the privacy law. So security is actually a key privacy principle, making sure that you have appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards in place for the data is required under virtually every privacy law. There's a few that don't. And in cases where the particular law doesn't, usually in the same country or jurisdiction, they've got another law that specifically focuses on security controls or security breach requirements, which inherently then will cause you to have security controls if you need to avoid the security breaches. But I would say, having a partner in the CISO has been really critical in my view for 15 plus years at this point in time. When I first started doing privacy, we looked at it more from a legal and policy perspective. There was not as much of a focus on the data and what's happening with the data. But that's just changed dramatically. So everything that we do is really about the data. People talk about privacy policies, and we just talked about standard contractual clauses. It's all about the data, knowing what data you are collecting, where you're collecting it, how you're protecting it, all of the, where you're transferring it to. Everything is about the data, and including the value of the data, the risk associated with the data, as it does all of the various different things I just described. And so partnering together with someone who's responsible for the security environment, understanding the appropriate way to balance and mitigate security risk, and thinking about those together through the lens of appropriate privacy protections, including how you design privacy and security controls effectively into things in an integrated way, as opposed to let's do the privacy thing and then let's do the security thing. Like, that's not good for getting business done. So that's how I would start.
Cool.
Exactly. I just to echo that, I think, you know, when we look at privacy and security, these are fundamentally whole of enterprise endeavors. You really do need to understand what type of information the organization collects, how it's used, which systems it kind of traverses, where it's shared, all those things. And I think from a CISO perspective, I look at a privacy officer as a natural colleague, a natural collaborator in terms of developing good governance models, good security and privacy models. And frankly, if you were to kind of boil all those down, at the end of the day, it's good risk management. You know, is the organization a good steward over the information that we're collecting, especially information that is sensitive in nature, be it protected health information, personal data, things of that nature, I think are fundamental part of our charge as leaders in an organization to use those assets correctly and do it in a way that's respectful, legally appropriate with respect to the data subject or the consumer's interests. So one thing I would add is I think when you look at a chief information security officer or a chief privacy or data protection officer, in many ways, these are trust building roles. And there's an economist out of the World Bank named Stephen Knack that talks about the value of trust from an economic perspective. At the end of the day, when us as consumers give our information to an organization, if they use it correctly and they're kind of building value, that engenders trust. If I give my information to Ferraro Enterprises and it's being used in a way that I didn't anticipate or wasn't communicated to me appropriately in a notice, that's kind of diminishing trust. And so I think the DPO or the chief privacy officer and the CISO, we're fundamentally about how do we protect the trust that is kind of implicit or inherent with the organization. And we have a fiduciary responsibility to do the same.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And Hillary, one thing I wanted to follow up on when you were talking about kind of the way that maybe it used to be where privacy officers were, I wanted to make sure I understood what you were kind of saying. It was around like there was kind of a disconnect maybe between what a privacy officer, like they were mostly focused on the business side of it and kind of the making sure that we were following, you know, the law and all of that, but maybe a disconnect between like the technology systems themselves, like knowing exactly where the data is or yeah, that kind of thing. Is that?
Yeah, let me elaborate a little bit. So in the earlier days, I mean, privacy started as less focused on exactly what was happening with data. I mean, you always needed to have some sense. I would say less focused on overall operations associated with privacy and the data and more on the giving of advice and, you know, here's what the law requires. I mean, these laws are rather complicated, to be honest. Like, we've got a lot of different requirements. And there's a lot of nuance in their interpretations. There's a lot more focusing on giving of advice, broader policy considerations. And then if I go back to my early days of doing privacy, so in addition to like writing the privacy notice or writing the consent, making sure you had, you know, all the right check boxes with the right language around them, that's what we spent a lot of time on. We moved more to, I would say, you know, how do you put that contextually inside of a web page, like when you're collecting data? Like, there was a lot of that early on. And then when the security breach laws were enacted, it became much more about, all right, what data do we have? Where is it? Who has access to it? Because if we have a breach, we need to know everything so we can make the right decisions to notify. And then that, of course, even without comprehensive data security laws, caused people to be much more worried about where's my data, what kind of data, to Matt's point, what kind of sensitivity, what laws get triggered as a result. So that was really the start of it being less about so much advice, yeah, and a lot of writing, if you will. That all still happens, but much more about operations around privacy. And that then involved, like, you need to work closely with the business that's actually using all the data and the people who understand the technology, who can make sure all the right controls are in place. And oftentimes, I mean, I'll just tell you, like in the early business days, when we were looking at, okay, how do we describe exactly what we're doing? So we're collecting this data in this web form, and then where is it going? The business people had no idea. Right. I mean, you're like, okay, can you please bring your IT person so we can talk to you about your plans and the IT people about how it actually works? And sometimes then you find out then when you're getting into cloud services, well, we actually need to bring the vendor because the vendor needs to tell us. So it long-winded way of saying that it became less about what you were writing and much more about what you were doing and the right controls around that.
Yeah.
And then as that evolved, really, I would say in my experience, between about 2006 to about 2011, that's when many who were kind of in the more forefront of like how do privacy and security work together saw what the CISOs were doing around, you know, putting all these like control frameworks in place for security and automating security risk management. And we started thinking, well, shouldn't we be doing that for privacy too? And I'll tell you, the first RFP I did for a vendor to do this to help, there weren't any.
Exactly.
And now there's like 200 privacy tech vendors in the market. It's amazing how it's evolved.
Yeah, maybe Hillary, we could. That's a good segue to kind of, I'd like to learn a little more about kind of TrustArc and just like, what are these, it sounds like these kind of platforms and things are to actually help you implement these kind of policy, make sure that you're actually being able to do these things in practice. Is that, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, unpack that a little bit and help us understand what are these different kinds of technology vendors, you know, what are they doing for companies and why, you know, why do we care, you know?
Sure, Paul. No, it's a great question. So I would say, you know, going back and kind of looking at it through a historical lens, back in that early part, when we were focused on writing stuff, nobody cared. Like if you said, we have a privacy technology, like people cared a little bit about whether it was detecting what was happening on your websites with cookies and trackers, a little bit, not a lot. Only to the extent that it helped them perhaps simplify the way they wrote privacy policies. And those were some of the early technologies out there. People started caring a little bit more in the late part of, around 2009, 2010. So there started being concerns about, like, can we actually detect what data is flowing out of the organization that shouldn't be flowing out of this organization? So it was a lot of the security teams were looking at data leakage prevention. There was a query on the privacy side of, can I actually better understand where my data is flowing? Like, can you detect a social security number? Can you detect a credit card number? And those, what we found pretty early on is, it was easy to detect things that had certain formats. It was a lot harder to detect things that didn't have any kind of structured format to them. So anyway, why do people care? As we sought, so two drivers. One is, as we sought to deal with all the different laws that started getting enacted. When I first started doing privacy, there were 15 different countries in the world that had privacy laws. Today, there are over 130, and there are close to 1,000 different privacy laws. And depending on how you look at them, you could say there's double that. There's a lot of different requirements. So the one reason people care is to try to simplify all of that complexity of all of these requirements. Do I need to read every law? Do I go to a lawyer to read every law for me? Then how do I boil that down into what I need to do? Because a lawyer is going to write a legal opinion for me, or they'll, you know, write a blog and give me some highlights of the things. How do I then turn that into something I can talk to my marketing team or my HR team or my engineering team or my research team about what they can and can't do in terms of collecting the data, in terms of using data they already have, in terms of combining data sets and things? I mean, one of the big things that has been a significant concern, especially post GDPR, is I've got all this data I've collected for decades. What am I allowed to do with it? Do I have to get rid of it all now? So we can come back to that if it makes sense. But so one thing is just figuring out all the requirements and figuring out when they apply. So a big thing that we've been working on since I came to TrustArc in 2016 is how do we help companies more simply figure out based on what they're doing with data, the industry sector they're in, where they operate, what laws apply, just flag it for you. So we actually develop and run algorithms based on the laws to help you just see what applies to you. Then you need to know what to do about it. So in terms of knowing what to do about it, that's when you kind of need the other side of technology, which isn't just about the law. It's much more about how do you know what you're doing with data? How do you track and follow through what's happening with the data? So, for example, there's a lot of technology and there's a lot of promise around technology that's kind of an extension of how I talked about data leakage prevention and that kind of technology, in that you detect what they call data discovery. So you detect where the data may be in a structured data set and an unstructured set of data. Like, can you figure out where the data is, what it is, classify it appropriately, assign risk levels to it, figure out where it's flowing, what responsibilities attach to it as it flows, figure out how you're going to protect it appropriately based on all of that. And then if you get, for example, a privacy rights request under CCPA or a data subject rights request under GDPR, and you need to respond to that request, whether it's give me access to all the data about me and tell me how you're using it, which is basically what these access requests are about, that you can do a quick query and be able to respond in the very short timeframes that you have. So under GDPR, you basically have a month.
And you'd feel confident that you actually had a quality response, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's almost to the point today, I would say, you know, 10 years ago, we felt we could still comply with all these requirements with Excel spreadsheets and email. Today, it's you can't meet the timelines because they've established deadlines. Some of the countries actually have deadlines as short as 5 days to respond to these requests. And if you think about reach notification requirements, like, you need to be able to respond so quickly, and you want to enable your teams to be able to deal with things when they happen in a way that doesn't blow up the whole business because everybody is completely diverted from their ordinary course. So you want this to kind of be running in the background. Things happen, you detect it, you have a team that deals with it, it gets escalated, and then you respond as you need to. I mean, that's the ideal you want to be able to way you want to be able to handle these things. And automation is essential to be able to handle both the figuring out what your requirements are and figuring out how all your what you're doing with all the data and how those two things come together.
Got it.
One thing I would add is you need this type of tooling. In fact, when Hillary, when you first kind of described that point in time when all of a sudden privacy tooling started to reach the market, and it was almost like a kid looking at another kid's toys with envy. You know, look at the neat stuff the security folks have, and the security folks used to look at all the neat stuff the IT folks had, and you know, so that. But effectively, it's required for us to be able to respond to these things appropriately. One of the challenges is, for example, in the U.S., there are safe harbor provisions if, for example, data is encrypted. There are also thresholds, like if you were to have a data breach in California, if it's 500 records are compromised, you have to notify the state attorney general. So what do you do if if Oregon says X and Alabama says Y and North Dakota Z and California is A, all these different things, how do you kind of manage that on scale? And then what is kind of the corporate philosophy? We had 400 records breached. Do we notify even if the regulation says 500? You know, there's an implicit kind of corporate approach or almost their culture in how transparent they are. But without these tools, without this visibility that Hillary beautifully described, is fundamentally you're acting blind. And what's fascinating to me is if we juxtapose how Europeans see this versus what we see here in the United States, it's very distinct. The European view is you should know this stuff. This should not be some great mystery. It should have already been known. You should have very clear you should have clarity on where this information resides, who has access to it, how many records, et cetera. And Paul, going back to our days in the storage networking user group and all the things, you know, all this massive amounts of unstructured data, effectively we've got this detritus of just data that has been thrown upon us over the years in the U.S. And now we're trying to figure out what the heck do we have? Where should it be? Who should have access to it? What do we do with it? All that. You can't do these things, to Hillary's point, manually. You have to tool up, as it were.
Yeah. Well, we had a big enough job, Matt, just trying to make sure that we didn't lose the data, let alone know what the heck it all was or who was using it or all these other questions that are, you know, now seem like they're kind of like no-brainer, that you definitely want to know all these things. You know, it's really interesting how far it's come.
Can I throw in one point for just a moment, but it's an important one.
Of course you can.
When we think about privacy and when we think about security, we have kind of this forgotten stepchild of all of our colleagues and friends and business continuity and BCDR planning. And when we think about like a business impact analysis, this is one of the most powerful tools that we have at our disposal, because it tells us what are the processes that the organization has, whether it's accounts receivable, accounts payable, sales marketing, customer relationship marketing, any number of different activities. That BIA fundamentally informs what are those processes. And as a CPO or as a CISO, I can take a look at that BIA and say, okay, I get it. This particular process is collecting data elements that are subject to regulatory oversight and certain types of controls. Here's another process that we really do need to lock down the security. I've got interfaces here that I need to validate from a security perspective. And I think one of the beauties of privacy and one of the beauties of security as a discipline and a domain is it's fundamentally where the rubber hits the road in terms of what the organization does. You know, too much of our time, I think historically in security, we were protecting assets like a server or a network and not necessarily thinking about protecting the information that used that asset, like a server or a network or an application. And I think privacy is that beautiful field that fundamentally allows us to have a greater level of intimacy in terms of what our organization is doing, how it does it, and where value is fundamentally derived. My segue to the BIA, or my ode to the BIA.
I like the BIA because, you know, in the privacy space, we have the PIA,
yep,
which comes very hand in hand with it. And the GDPR gave us the DPIA. So we sort of rounded it all up to an impact assessment is important.
Exactly. You got to know what you have.
I like that. How do you guys keep track of all these acronyms?
You
have a tool for that?
You take your hand and you write them on your hand.
It is hard to keep up with all the acronyms. There's new ones every day. And the funny thing, though, is as privacy, security, data governance, other aspects of technology come together, one of the things that we're starting to see is that there are certain acronyms that have come up in different fields that actually are the same acronym and they mean different things.
Yep.
It'll be interesting to see how that evolves in the next couple of years.
Exactly.
That's always fun when acronyms between, you know, companies themselves use a lot of acronyms about their own business units and all these things, and you mix them all together, it's like a word salad of nonsense when you come into it and you know maybe a new company and you're like, what is all this stuff? Is this an acronym, a real one, or is this one you guys made up yesterday?
every company should have its own acronym glossary, because there's no possible way to know half the stuff.
Exactly.
I just lost my question that I had. I know what it was. So we were talking a little bit, Hillary, about the kind of the trust arc and a platform. What are some of the things that you're seeing just from insights from, you probably talk to, who actually, that's a good, another question is who do you typically talk to? Are you talking to privacy officers a lot of times, or are you talking to CISOs as well, or CEOs, or who do you typically engage with?
At TrustArc, as a platform provider, we engage with a number of different stakeholders in the organization. So one of our primary users is, of course, the privacy team. So it would be the CPO or DPO. So I'm throwing more acronyms, Chief Privacy Officer, Data Protection Officer, and his or her team. Oftentimes, they'll have somebody on the team who's charged with kind of managing, doing project management or certain operations management. So for example, somebody who's responsible for running all the vendor assessments, and that person may work very closely with somebody on the security team who does vendor assessments too. In fact, they sometimes have very integrated processes. That's one of the things we try to help facilitate. You may have somebody who's responsible for all of the data subject rights requests. and managing them as they come in. Because with all the laws now, a lot of companies are getting dozens per day. Many of them aren't necessarily valid requests, but you have an obligation to process them all. So there's like people who are doing the operations that are the users, and then there's the people who get all the reporting and the insights on what's going on. I would say with respect to our research, a lot of it's the privacy team primarily that uses all of the research tools. The broader organization is seeing, you know, the highlights of that as part of a dashboard. Here are the things that are relevant to you every day. But as I mentioned already, so, you know, our technology that we offer at TrustArc is designed to help facilitate organizations working together on privacy, because it's all about the data in the business. And like a big thing oftentimes, and I use examples of different groups before. So like your marketing team may be planning to implement a new marketing software. Maybe it's a content management software, or they want to do a new campaign and they want to use data differently than they have historically. And usually, no offense to any teams, but a lot of times people are like, thinking about the plan, and then somebody says, oh, did you talk to the privacy team? I'm planning to implement tomorrow. So, and then of course, then the privacy team says, well, you know, we need to go through these things. And they mean, they're like, what do you mean there's all these things? So anyway, long way of saying, one of the things that we try to facilitate through the technology is helping people identify early on in their project planning there are privacy and security things you need to do, facilitating those privacy and security analyses working together and giving people kind of operational insights. And here's where your thing is in the review process. Here's the stuff that's missing from you. You think it's sitting with the privacy team, who's the voice of no, but actually it's waiting on you to finish this remediation. So yeah, we try to engage the whole organization, but some of the primary users are in the privacy team, like the, and then the broader kind of respondents within the organization could be anywhere. The security team uses specific pieces that are relevant to its insights, but that's a big thing that privacy platform providers are trying to do, is work together with the traditional security application and platform providers to make sure that there's good integrations as well. Good integrations too with like digital asset management systems. So, you know, if you're using a digital asset management system to keep track of all of your applications, how do you make sure that all of that's just naturally fed into the privacy system? So as you're going through and doing a systems impact assessment, to use our impact assessment term again, that that's all integrated and like the checkbox of yes, good to go, this system's meeting its privacy requirements, and separately it's met its security requirements in another system, that's all rolled up for the organizations that need to be responsible.
Got it. So it could open up a can of worms, but it could open up a bunch of areas where maybe you have areas that you haven't done analysis on, or right, if you start saying, hey, we'd like to connect this to your application, you know, your list of applications that you have, and they're like, oh yeah, we don't have that, or right, then it kind of helps you improve a bunch of other areas maybe that need to be cleaned up as well. Matt, you look like you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's such a great source of enterprise visibility. I mean, this is one of the true values. People think of privacy and security as kind of an overhead in a lot of ways. But fundamentally, you know, we kind of shine the light on areas that hadn't necessarily been thought of from a risk perspective, from an enterprise value perspective before. And just in Hillary kind of describing all the great things that TrustArc and these platforms are able to do, you can see why the spreadsheet's been deprecated.
Exactly. Yeah, actually,
that's something I was curious about, is like, what are some of the risks for not doing these things? Like, what happens to companies that are maybe, you know, not doing this stuff as well as they should be? I mean, what does that look like?
I'll take it from a high level security perspective. If you don't know what type of information you have, you don't know how to protect it accordingly, and you may be subject to a data breach because the appropriate or requisite controls simply weren't there. You're also, I think, subject to some really interesting oversight, in fact, regulatory action from the Federal Trade Commission. In its enforcement of Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, focusing on unfair and deceptive trade practices, these can end up being in kind of 20-year biennial audits, and they can be very intrusive. There's a potential for fines that are associated with it. So I think really, from my view, knowing what you have and how it's protected and locking that down is really critical for just good enterprise governance. And Hillary, sorry about that. I know you were about to weigh in as well.
No, I'm happy to augment and add to some of the things you already said, which are terrific. So one of the things I just wanted to point out that I think is really important here is a lot of people will say, well, what's the risk of the fine? Because if I'm not, if I can kind of stay under the radar, why do I need to worry? And, you know, the reality is GDPR introduced huge fines. So you can be fined as an organization up to 4% of your annual revenue. Or if you're a little organization, $20 million or 20 million euro, whichever is greater. So think about that. You're a company that makes 20 million euros or what, I guess if we were to do the math here, about $22 million per year, you could be subject to all of that going away. Now, people say, oh, they're not going to detect me. Why would they focus on me versus all the other companies? And perhaps if you don't process a lot of sensitive data, you're not doing things that can make people very suspicious that you're surveilling them, perhaps you won't. However, here's what I would say is the primary risk for organizations if they don't do this right. You're not going to win the customers. You go into an RFP and you're like, I have this great new tech that I can offer to you. And the customer or the prospects are looking at all the different possible vendors in the space.
Yeah.
And guess what they do these days? They do a security assessment. They do a privacy assessment. They check in whether you can meet all the data processing requirements in the contract provisions that you need to agree to before you actually win the RFP. If you can't do that stuff, you're not going to win. So exactly. From a business-to-business standpoint, that's the huge risk. Do you have adequate controls in place from a security and privacy perspective, regardless of whether anybody's ever going to find you, that you're going to win that business deal and you're going to keep that business deal? Because they do audit. They want to audit. They want to make sure that you are not subjecting them to risk. So I think the business-to-business risk is actually the biggest risk out there.
One concern that I have is all of these requirements in the aggregate effectively introduce a kind of a barrier to entry for smaller, earlier stage innovative companies. So you think about, I want to build an application. I want to go have it hosted in some public cloud. I also need to get a SOC 2 audit, and I need to be able to respond to all these vendor questionnaires. In the aggregate, it's putting an enormous burden. I don't know how we solve this, but I think it's something we need to throw out there. Very, very large organizations have teams that are dedicated to addressing this. Smaller companies, you know, even companies with several hundred employees, so not really micro enterprises in any way, shape, or form. This is a real administrative burden for them in terms of how they approach this. And the only way I can think about how you do this well is shifting left and doing everything by design. So you build privacy in early, you build security in early. Literally, Article 25 of the GDPR talks about data protection by design and by default. But still, there's a lot of administrative cost in addressing this correctly. And what I hope we don't ultimately see is something where only the large enterprises are able to compete because of these implicit requirements or explicit requirements more appropriately.
And you hit the nail on the head, Matt, as to why I liked Privacy Shield, Safe Harbor, the privacy framework and the cross-border privacy rules and the PA. Like, this is what's necessary for smaller organizations.
Yeah.
It does cost a lot of money to be able to show that you're meeting the requirements. To sign up, you don't have the administrative overhead of like all of the transactional, like every time like you have to enter into these standard contractual clauses, like there's a lot of overhead there. So I actually think framework-based approaches to demonstrating that you're meeting standards are the best. And it's like a SOC 2, but if we can help organizations actually do that better through technology and as you said, it's the privacy by design, it's the security by design, and making sure that as you're building your products, you're building this stuff in from the outset. It's easy as you're planning, like, what's my new innovation I'm going to bring to market? Ask yourself at the same time, how am I going to make sure that that innovation actually meets privacy requirements? And if you build that in from the very beginning, not only is it going to be easy to get your privacy certification or your security, your SOC 2, because you'll have most of the stuff. I mean, yes, there's some governance things as well, but you'll be able to do that a lot easier. And then I would say, I do think that technology is going to be key for the smaller organizations. And it's important that it be simple and straightforward enough for them so that they can simply produce a report that says, yes, see, I'm at this standard, I'm certified here, or I have this audit and this validation letter, and therefore I'm already meeting all your requirements. So please don't burden me with having to do it 10 times over and over and over again. That's right. Actually one of the things we're working on right now is how do we make it easier for companies, particularly smaller organizations, to not have to answer the same questions over and over and over and over again for different organizations.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's just no way you're going to be able to get them to be able to comply with all these things. They're going to give up, and they're going to either just run the risk, or, you know, they probably, like you said before, I mean, they want to try to comply with these things, but if it's just too difficult, so one other thing I was curious about was things like facial recognition and these other types of new, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff in the press about facial recognition recently, but, you know, how are things like this impacting the privacy world, and what are your, I'd be interested in Hillary, your thoughts on that, and then we could get Matt's thoughts too,
Yeah, I mean, look, new technology, it's exciting. It's fun to be able to do things you couldn't otherwise do. The problem is that oftentimes organizations, this goes back to what Matt was saying earlier, organizations get excited about the new innovation and they don't think about the downside. And what we're really looking for, as privacy champions, I will call myself a champion, is for people to think about when you're developing something new, do that impact analysis of the people who are going to use it and the impacts to society as a whole, and how do you design it in a way that you actually maximize the opportunity while minimizing the risks, not only to the people whose data are being used, so in the case of facial recognition, you know, not just the people whose pictures are being, I should say, not just the people who actually use the tech, but the people who are the subjects of the tech. How are they going to respond? And like, what does this mean for like the broader society when all of a sudden, you know, you can walk down the street, somebody's taking your picture and they're posting it and you have no privacy anymore at all. Like, who signed up for that?
Yeah,
exactly. There's interesting legislation that's being worked through in Washington state, you know, which looks like it might be the first state to introduce more appropriate controls around facial recognition. But there's also, from a technology perspective, the efficacy and fidelity of the actual algorithms that are doing this. And so there's a lot of inherent bias in the way facial recognition software is being built today. And then there's notions like there's algorithms like k-anonymization algorithms. How quickly can I re-identify somebody in a group of, quote, de-identified individuals or data subjects? Some of this stuff, I think, from a mathematical perspective, is still very challenged. And so I think it's fascinating. It certainly is Big Brother-esque. I mean, we certainly are seeing this in Hong Kong with the protesters and the attempts by the Chinese government to use facial recognition to identify those individuals that are protesting and things of that nature. So it's got really dangerous implications if it's not managed well. And I think as we do a mad dash into facial recognition, in light of what we just saw with Privacy Shield and how the Europeans look at kind of wholesale surveillance practices that take place, it has the potential to be another trade barrier if it's not well thought out. It really does require a lot of policy thinking, as well as kind of the really fascinating mathematical and algorithmic work that's being done on the actual software.
And I'll just throw in one, I know we're coming toward the end of our time, but one last point there. the ethics around it. So this is not where you can just look at what does the law say. It's the ethics, and you need to think broadly about both impact to individuals, the societal impacts as well, and to Matt's point, you know, disparate impacts to different classes of people, and what that means in the different societies that it will be implemented. There's a lot of very careful considerations that need to be given, and the problem that we see repeatedly is people oftentimes rush much too fast to bring out some new technology without thinking through how best it can be used in society at large.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I can't believe it's already been, our time's already up. I have like 10 more questions, but this has been really great, Hillary. I really appreciate your time and coming on and talking with us today. And Matt, of course, always great to talk to you. But thank you so much, Hillary.
Thank you guys so much. It was a pleasure. And if you have 10 more questions, I'm happy to join you again at some point.
All right, perfect.
Hillary, this was fantastic.
We'd love to. Once you get through the 63 pages of the
my third time through it. I need to get through it.
Awesome. Exactly. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the TNT podcast, Technology and Things, hosted by Paul Ferraro and Jeff Krueger. We'll see you next time.